nations, no borders, no nations, no coal power stations. We are unstoppable. Another world is possible. No more coal, no more oil. Keep your carbon in the soil. Good evening, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. Energy is the stuff of life, and certainly it's a basic need. But access to energy is also a function of individual and household wealth. And as the cost of electricity continues to rise in California, the poor can afford to buy less and less. This happens here, even in the fifth largest economy in the world. Today, our focus is on energy justice and equity in California and why our private utilities are failing in this issue. My guest is Shaina Nanavati. Are you there, Shaina?
Hi, yes, I am.
Okay, Shaina is a research organizer for the Reclaim Our Power Utility Justice Campaign and a member of the steering committee of the Local Clean Energy Alliance. She has experience as a community organizer and climate justice activist in North Carolina. They also previously worked with North Carolina's electric cooperatives and conducted research on expanding clean energy and energy efficiency services available to co-op members. Reclaim Our Power is a statewide initiative mobilizing a broad coalition of utility ratepayers, social justice advocates, and allies to develop an equitable, sustainable, decentralized restructuring of California's energy system. Well, Shaina, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much.
So,
go ahead. Really quickly, I just wanted to say I am not actually yet a member of the steering committee for LCEA, but Reclaim Our Power is a project of LCEA, and so I am LCEA staff, and so that's why my name's on there. But thank you for reading off my bio. Yeah.
My mistake. So tell us a little bit about Reclaim Our Power and its goals.
Yeah, so Reclaim Our Power, the utility justice campaign, is a statewide initiative to mobilize social justice advocates, utility ratepayers, and wildfire survivors to demand a transformation of our energy system here in California. So our focus is on the state's largest criminal utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, and the regulatory agency that enables its violence, the California Public Utilities Commission, or the CPUC. So the campaign was started after PG&E's Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing in 2019 and the ensuing plan that was supported by the governor and pushed through the legislature in order to allow them to not only come out of bankruptcy, but to shield them from future wildfire liabilities. The campaign's goals are to block a PG&E bailout, democratize our energy system, and to create a new one that meets the needs of frontline communities. So we're fighting regulatory capture within our agencies and making sure that environmental justice communities have a seat at the table when decisions are being made that affect us. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about, just like our work around PG&E and the bankruptcy filing and why we're doing this.
Well, I was curious. You used the term violence to talk about PG&E in particular. And I was wondering if you can explain that particular term. What kind of violence is PG&E engaged in, according to your campaign?
Uh-huh. I mean, they are convicted felon. They have 84 counts of manslaughter on their hands, right?
So, right. Yeah.
I mean, in terms of their the violence that they cause is literally has cost human lives, but there's just the continual violence of the wildfires that they're causing. And have been causing for years.
Uh-huh. Okay, I see that. So who belongs to the coalition?
So we work with a ton of groups who are doing work both locally and at a state and national level, and our members represent communities in East Oakland, San Francisco, the North Bay, as well as groups representing environmental justice communities across the state. So we work with disability justice advocates, ratepayer advocates, youth and wildfire survivors. And our campaign structure is actually pretty unique. So we aren't a nonprofit of our own, but we have groups represented by our leadership team who really help drive our decision-making process. And outside of that, we organize with a variety of climate justice, housing justice, economic and racial justice groups here in the state, as well as folks working on energy democracy across the country. And if you're curious, you can see a list of our leadership team members on our website at reclaimourpowerca.org.
Why is this campaign necessary? Because, I mean, who is or what is against energy justice and equity in California?
Yeah, so let me give a little bit of background of, you know, why we started.
Sure.
So PG&E filed for bankruptcy after facing lawsuits for criminal negligence that led to tens of billions of dollars in liabilities for them from the 2017 and 2018 wildfire seasons and the fires that they caused through their malfunctioning equipment, lack of investment in safety upgrades and, you know, vegetation management. And so then their plan of organization was approved in 2020 without any consideration given to the destruction that they were still causing at the time with the 2019 and 2020 fires. And we know that they've already said that their equipment has likely caused the Dixie Fire, which is currently the largest, you know, in state history. And so what we're calling for is a process to hold PG&E accountable to the public. We're also fighting for a plan to restructure our energy system to create one that's democratic, decentralized, and distributed. And, you know, the current system is one that really prioritizes shareholder and executive profits and totally lacks transparency. The current system depends on these long-distance transmission lines that are transporting, you know, fossil fuel-generated electricity across the state. And that's what's leading to these massive wildfires. And so our vision that we're trying to spread is of a worker and community-controlled system of resilient energy generation and distribution, one that really allows us to just live healthy and happy lives rather than burn down the state. Yeah, and so, you know, there's the fires that are, you know, literally burning down our state. As I said, you know, so many lives have been lost as a direct result of these fires. And on top of that, you have the health effects, multiplying effects of the pandemic, wildfire smoke, decades of disinvestment in low-income communities of color. And on top of that, they're raising electricity rates, right, to cover the cost of making these upgrades and safety enhancements that they've really neglected for decades that are long overdue.
Why do you think that the utility ignored these, you know, let the system degrade the way that it appears to have done? Well, what was behind that?
I think you have to understand how PG&E makes their money.
Good.
So
yeah.
it's not making a system safer, but they're basically allowed to recover their costs through rate increases, and they're actually allowed a guaranteed rate of return that's approved by the CPUC. That really is for building more infrastructure and then passing those costs down on to their customers. So you can kind of think of this in terms of like how the real estate market works, right? Like investors will make money just by building, not just through charging rents, right? And so, you know, that's why we have all these empty luxury apartment buildings lying around while construction still continues. And so investor-owned utilities work in the same way. They bring in a fixed percentage of revenue based on how much they're building. And that includes, you know, generation, distribution, and transmission projects, like saying they're going to bury power lines. And so what that really does is, like, it gives them incentive to build rather than do anything to actually create a safer system.
The paradox, though, is, it seems to me, is that the system has been built up slowly over the last 100 years, right? And it's long been amortized. I mean, it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of a parallel. It's kind of like when you buy a house after you've paid off the mortgage, the bank doesn't keep coming after you saying, you know, you're still operating the house and you still owe us money. It's not a very good analogy. But surely the cost of the transmission system was amortized, you know, decades ago. So how is it that they can charge operation and maintenance and, you know, and upgrades on a system which is, in some respects, you know, 50 years old or more?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because they do have, you know, like the campfire, it came out was, you know, caused by like a nearly 100-year-old hook that was broken that just nobody had been replaced. And so, I mean, there is no, I think there just hasn't been the oversight that is required to make sure that they're doing these upgrades. And once they rate based a certain project, once it's built, you know, there's no profit in maintenance. You know, that's a cost.
Well, you know, I mean, one could certainly, you know, set rates according to the quality of service. I mean, it's not necessarily the case that you set rates on the basis of the value, the market value of the system, right? And in the case of a utility, well, we'll come back to that in a little while. But what I wanted to ask was what you do as the research organizer for Reclaim Our Power, and how you got into this business.
Yeah. So when I had first actually heard about this job, I was like, oh, research organizer, that really sounds like an oxymoron. So many times, you know, academic research just lives and happens in a completely separate reality from organizing work, right?
Yeah.
But the question that I posed at the beginning was really like, how does my research inform our organizing work? And so I came to this campaign after living in North Carolina for 6 years, and I grew up in San Jose, and I went to UC Davis where I studied economics and philosophy. And just growing up here, you know, I was really lucky enough to be exposed to the science of climate change, you know, which just isn't a reality in a lot of states. There were really two world events that shaped my understanding of the inequities of the impacts of climate change, I'd say. And that was, you know, Hurricane Katrina and the Syrian civil war. So for me, you know, climate justice is inherently anti-imperialist, anti-racist, anti-fascist work. And so when we talk about frontline communities on a global scale, we're talking about the global South.
Right.
And as someone, you know, that I really care about always says, the American South is the global South. So when we come back to California, here our people on the front line are Black and Brown people who are migrants and refugees who have been coming here, you know, for the past 150 plus years in order to escape the violence in their own countries caused by the U.S. military, as well as, you know, from the southern U.S. after emancipation. And it also includes the indigenous peoples of this land where people lived for, you know, 10,000 years before the gold rush or even before Spanish colonization.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, you know, how I mentally approach this work. But anyway, I moved out to North Carolina for grad school, and then I worked for North Carolina's rural electric cooperatives where I started off as an analyst. And then in 2018... in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence and the devastation that it caused, you know, our members in rural North Carolina, I wrote a letter to the CEO and was like, you know, we need to publicly acknowledge climate change and we need to oppose the pipelines that the co-op and, you know, investor-owned utilities were trying to build together because it's directly impacting our members. And so then I was brought into his office and told very politely that this was not the place for activism because, you know, even though it's a cooperative, it's a utility. And, you know, that's the place for slow, gradual change. And so I left to become an organizer. And I worked on climate justice and then voter engagement out in North Carolina for a while as a means to get back into climate and energy policy. And so I decided to come back to California for a few reasons. So, you know, the climate crisis here is a lot more advanced than in other parts of the country. And so there's a lot more urgency for finding solutions. And I also think, you know, it's starting to affect rich white people. So there's an appetite for it.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Shaina Nanavati, the research organizer for the Reclaim Our Power Utility Justice Campaign in California. And we have been talking about how she got into this business and some other issues having to do with the local private utility, Pacific Gas and Electric. Well, let's get back to the focus on energy justice and equity. You know, as electric ratepayers, a lot of us don't know anything about how the system impacts low-income and frontline communities, the particular electric system. I mean, we pay bills every month, right? And that's really pretty much all that we see. And one of the questions that always comes up is, you know, how is this unjust? I mean, after all, we expect people to pay for power. But was the California power system built to discriminate against minorities and the poor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the California power system is like all the other systems in California in that it has explicitly anti-Black and anti-Indigenous underpinnings. And I have to say that the cause of energy injustice is really the same as the cause of all injustices, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is capitalism, the system of extraction of resources from the earth in a way that prioritizes profits for a few over the well-being of, you know, everyone else. and, you know, white supremacy, to just call it out, has its chokehold on our institutions just as much as anywhere else in this country, you know, here. And, you know, on top of that, the way that kind of the land and natural resource ownership works in the state is so rooted in colonialism and our state's history of genocide. And so really, you know, naming these things is kind of how Reclaim Our Power is doing that work of, like, you know, I think just bringing not just bringing attention, but like changing the vision of what's possible. So when we talk about institutions, our work right now has been focusing on the California Public Utilities Commission, which is the regulatory body for the investor-owned utilities. And there's a known revolving door between PG&E and the CPUC. And so the commissioners are then also appointed by the governor, who gets hundreds of thousands of dollars in money from PG&E lobbyists. So it's this dark web that's been spun by millionaires who are so disconnected from the reality of what it even means to be poor in California. And so a lot of my work, you know, the way that I bridge research and organizing, as I said before, you know, I was like, traditionally those are so separate, but it's through having conversations, you know. So the world of, you know, California's energy problems is too complex for any one person to hold all the knowledge or to know all the answers. And so we really work with, you know, community organizers as well as technical and political experts to really figure out where the moving parts are around any ongoing issue and then help bring that information to our campaign. And yeah, so really bringing up, like, bringing information to folks as a way to move us towards the solution that we all need.
Well, I want to follow. I want to follow up on that particular point in a few minutes. Okay, which is, what do people do with the information? But you mentioned the California Public Utilities Commission, which was established. Well, it's about 100. It's more than 100 years ago, right? To regulate monopoly utilities, private utilities, in the state, and you know, I think all 50 states and District of Columbia probably have something similar. But they were created during the Progressive Era with the idea that private, you know, corporations could not be relied on to do good just on their own initiative. So what happened? Why has the PUC become, let's just say, beholden to the private utilities?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, have they ever not been? You know, well, the CPUC's role is to regulate the private utilities. And so to some extent, their job is dependent on the private utility existing, you know. but really, you know, what we see here in California, which I think is not so different from probably any other state, but is just, yeah, the, like, when we talk about regulatory capture, it's the money flowing, right? It's the fossil fuel money, really, which is what the utility industry is, the fossil fuel industry. And so that money is flowing, you know, to the governor, then from there to the commissioners he appoints, then make these decisions. And on top of that, you know, there's a lot of staff that works at the agency too, that makes a lot of these recommendations. And I think just the industry is just so entrenched in this old way of thinking that is really derived from this centralized fossil fuel model of energy that just isn't working for us anymore.
Well, let me push on that for a little bit. The way that I understand the PUC works is that the utilities decide they want to get more money, or they want to, you know, alter the tariffs. And so they put together a massive proposal to submit to the CPUC. And then the Public Utilities Commission holds public hearings on the proposal. And I've listened to a few of these hearings. They're usually fairly deadly dull. But why doesn't that work? Why doesn't that work then to effectively regulate what the utilities want?
So many times the decisions, you know, before these meetings are even held and the public comment periods are already held, the decision has already been made. And yeah, I mean, so a lot of, you know, our work with the Reclaim Our Power campaign is one thing we do is like have people show up to public comments during CPUC voting meetings. And we are, you know, I love my team, but we're a small group. And so we're really limited in our capacity. But so we can't engage in every single issue that comes up at the CPUC. And so rate cases is one of those, like we're not directly involved in that right now, but really just showing up at public comments and causing a scene and has really led to our demands being heard and even directly acknowledged by the commissioners themselves. I think where the situation is right now is like they are obviously aware that the current system isn't working. PG&E is, you know, still just bleeding money and continuing to cause fires, continuing to shut off power. And they kind of just don't know what to do because the alternative has just never been tried before. And so there's just a lot of entrenched, stuck thinking at all levels.
What are you proposing? What's the campaign proposing for the PUC?
Ooh, that is, if I figure that out, I will no longer have a job. yeah, I mean, that's part of what we're trying to figure out. But overall, I think, you know, what it looks like is more transparency than there currently is a public process for holding PG&E accountable and continuing, you know, to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And really, yeah, I mean, right, I think just the complete lack of transparency is the one thing that is really difficult for us to navigate because there's, you know, meeting agendas that are changed at the last minute where things are that were going to be voted on. For example, a few months back, there was at a CPUC voting meeting, the issue of PG&E's safety certificate was going to be brought back on to the table after basically, you know, just it was brought out that the safety certificate was approved with really it was a very rushed lack of process that left a lot of people in the dark. And the night before that meeting, that vote was just taken off the agenda. And so things like that, you know, it's just very shady.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of shadiness.
Yeah, well, you need to know something about how the whole thing operates, and that takes time and experience, I suppose. You mentioned there are revolving doors. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a history of folks working for the commission, even commissioners, who've then gone on to work for the investor-owned utilities. And there's really nothing in place to... I think that is one where there needs to be more, yeah, there definitely needs to be more oversight around not letting that happen. But I think beyond just, you know, like legal limits in terms of that flow of staff and executives from the utilities to their regulatory agencies, mm-hmm. I think just kind of there's like a cultural change, an ideological change, I think, that needs to happen of what the role of a regulator is. It's not just to keep a investor-owned utility or a business in business. It's to serve the public.
Well, that's the theory, at least, isn't it? If it's not the practice. Do you think that the system, you know, I mean, this has been going on now for over 100 years. Do you think that the whole system needs to be scrapped? Or is it possible to somehow reform or transform it? I'm talking about the regulatory system, mm-hmm. you know, not the, we'll come back to the utilities.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely are not in the business of reform. We definitely believe in transformation. I think that remains to be seen. It kind of depends on where, you know, again, it depends on the future of the utility. So there are, you know, power providers in California that do not answer to the Public Utilities Commission. In the same way that the investor-owned utilities do. For example, there are a few rural electric cooperatives in the state. Municipal power agencies, I'm pretty sure, don't, you know, have their rates set by the PUC or approved by the PUC. And so, I guess that's a future question in terms of where... Like who is going to own the energy system? And I think that really will determine the future of mm-hmm. what the regulation will look like. But it is a chicken and egg problem, because without regulatory change, it's hard to really make sure we're transforming, you know, the wires and generation in a meaningful way.
All right, you're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Shaina Nanavati, the research organizer for the Reclaim Our Power Utility Justice Campaign. We've just been, ragging on the California Public Utilities Commission, and a question came up about, you know, what to do or what sorts of alternatives there are. So let me ask you a slightly different question at this moment. Description on the web for Reclaim Our Power, the blurb, says that its goal is to develop an equitable, sustainable, decentralized restructuring of California's energy system. What would that look like?
Yeah. You know, we're honestly, like, that's something we're in the process of figuring out. Mm-hmm. As I said, by organizing the communities who are most impacted by the, as I said, like violence, right, of the existing system. And so one of the things that we kind of abide by are our, you know, 10 principles of utility justice, which I'll list out. So they are distributed power, worker and community control, mm-hmm. clean renewable energy for all, corporate accountability, frontline leadership, indigenous sovereignty and land stewardship, environmental justice, equitable emergency planning, protection of workers, and investing in climate resilience.
But my question was a little bit different. Okay, we were talking about a decentralized system, right? Which I presume would be based on renewable energy, and you mentioned municipal utilities not being subject to the regulation by the CPUC. So I'm assuming that the system would be under the control of local jurisdictions or municipalities. Would that be a fair assumption?
Potentially. That remains, like I said, to be seen. But one of the arenas that we're kind of involved with the kind of like just like is demonstration projects mm-hmm. of microgrids.
Yeah.
So there was a bill that led to a CPUC proceeding that created an incentive program for microgrids basically to be built in PG&E territory. And, you know, a microgrid can come in a variety of sizes, but it's basically a building or a set of buildings that can run on its own generated power and storage in case that it's disconnected from utility power for any reason. And so PG&E was told, you know, they've been told to give funds to allow for communities to build their own microgrids. But what we've been finding in this process is that they really aren't interested in allowing people to control their own energy systems. And the way that this specifically impacts low-income communities, because there's just so many ways that, you know, owning and managing your own energy system is economically empowering. So a centralized utility model where people are going into debt to keep the lights on while, you know, PG&E's executives get bonuses and salary increases is inherently discriminatory. Mm-hmm. It basically is, you know, a transfer of wealth. And so one of the things that we are working on with a lot of organizations that are involved with our campaign is on building community resilience hubs mm-hmm. so that people who can't afford to just stick solar panels on the roof or, you know, buy a battery storage system for their homes can still access electricity and basic services when, you know, PG&E is shutting off power or doing wildfire evacuations. And we know that these disasters have a multiplier effect on people who are already vulnerable and at risk. And so, you know, immigrants who may face language or documentation barriers to getting access to some of the meager resources that the state or utility provides, disabled folks who may not even be able to leave home or who require electricity for breathing equipment, refrigerating medicine, you know. So it's not just about the cost. And when we talk about, you know, the effects of this whole system, there's a lot of costs, and really resiliency is kind of like one of the things we focus on. And so a decentralized energy system is a resilient system, right? Beyond even our individual energy usage, energy is what powers our transportation system, our food system, our modes of production. And as we're kind of localizing all of these, then that is how we are able to bring any kind of, you know, economic empowerment to communities who have really been just disinvested in for mm-hmm. decades and decades. And so it's about, yeah.
Well, the utility or the state has this program, this CARES program. I can't remember what it stands for, but it basically provides electricity discounts to low-income households. Is this not sufficient in terms of, you know, giving some advantage to disadvantaged communities?
Well, you know, the equity problem is about so much more than just the monthly bill payments. It's about the historic and daily violence of the fossil fuel-driven centralized energy mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. And so in June, we were a part of a National Day of Action that was calling for the cancellation of utility debt. And a lot of the proposals that were being put forth were for public funds to be given to the utilities to wipe the over $2 billion in utility debt that was amassed during and wow. even before the pandemic. Yeah. And so I don't know all the details of how the CARE program works, but I know that it has a lot of requirements that are pretty restrictive that determine, you know, who can even qualify for these programs.
Yes.
And when we talk about energy and utility justice, it's really not about just the cost per kilowatt hour of electricity that you're paying every month on your bill. It's, as I said, it's about resiliency of our communities.
Well, you know, that concept of, I mean, we've talked about resiliency on the show before, and that concept of resiliency is a kind of a squishy one in my view. What PG&E has been proposing to do is put diesel generators in you know, communities that are subject to high risks, which certainly isn't what you have in mind, is it?
No, we are firmly against diesel microgrids or diesel generators at substations. This is another thing they're proposing. Yeah, we believe that's not a real solution, even if, you know, it was... they say that, you know, that will keep the power on for longer, but it's at what cost, right? The cost of just the, you know, pollution from these generators is also continuing to cause really disparate health problems and continual, you know, lifelong effects.
Yeah,
for children that grow up near them.
Yeah, I mean they're intended only for for essential facilities, right? That, I mean, this is the idea, is that you keep hospitals and police stations and other things like that online if the power goes out. What would a community resilience hub?
Well, you mentioned.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, please. Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say specifically to answer your question of what community resilience hubs would look like, and get to what you said about hospitals and police stations. You know, hospitals are already required to have their own generation on site, and a lot of times that is diesel, and it is what it is. But in terms of police stations, that is something our campaign is also firmly against. You know, we don't think that even just putting solar panels on a police station does anything to promote community resilience or safety. Yeah, no, definitely not. but when we talk about community resilience, you know, you think about electricity use on a personal level, charging your cell phones, running the AC when it's really hot. And right now, PG&E and the other investor-owned utilities in the state are being allowed to turn off the power in what they call these public safety power shutoffs. And they claim, you know, it's during severe weather events, so times that they're expecting high winds or thunderstorms. But they really provide such limited information to the public about how they even decide where and when to shut off the power. And so these shutoffs, we know, are really more about the perception that they're doing something in order to avoid the risk of sparking more fires than any commitment to public safety. And so communities are having to find ways to provide electricity when PG&E decides not to do its job. And so some of the groups that we've been working with, are building community centers and figuring out, you know, what locations in their communities and neighborhoods are able to host solar and storage projects. And then that can then be islanded from the main grid at times of, you know, power shutoffs. Mm-hmm. And then I think the main thing is, you know, a lot of community resilience isn't just about electricity. It's about providing a safe space, providing food, providing childcare, space for healing and cultural, you know, support. So it's about so much more than electricity, but electricity is kind of, you know, a basic It's a human right. It's a baseline for being able to provide all these other services.
So in the event of a power failure or shutoff or something like that, the resilience hub would provide a place for people to go to. Is that the basic idea? Because providing electricity for a neighborhood, you know, is a good deal more complicated than just for a single building. Are you there?
For sure, yeah. And so, you know, hello?
Yeah, no, go on. I can hear you. Go on, yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, I mean, so I'll say, you know, there are different, like every community has different needs.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And there are places where, you know, the idea of connecting different buildings or, you know, multi-family housing or local businesses or community centers is kind of the way to go. And there are other folks who are like, well, you know, we have one hub that or one building or one customer that really is a central location for folks to access services and resources. And so really it's a combination of things, and mm-hmm. we're working with groups all over Northern California, the Bay specifically, the North Bay, East Bay.
Are there any of these are any of these centers or these resilience hubs being built yet?
Yeah, they are. One of the projects that is we're, you know, really, really learning from is the RISE Center, which is a project. I can speak. Do you want me to talk more about specific project or?
Yeah. Okay. But hold, I need to take another break and then let's talk about that. Okay.
Sounds good.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. Second Harvest Food Bank of Santa Cruz County was the first food bank in California and the second in the nation. Its mission is for Santa Cruz County to be a community working together to end hunger. Regular biweekly food distributions rotate on Fridays from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. at the Santa Cruz County Fairgrounds in Watsonville. This is a drive-through distribution for residents of Santa Cruz County. To learn about other food distribution sites throughout the county, you can call your community food hotline at 831-662-0991. And more information is available on the website, thefoodbank.org. Well, this is Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Shaina Nanavati, research organizer for the Reclaim Our Power Utility Justice Campaign. And Shaina is just about to describe to us a community resilience hub that is being developed or built. Can you tell us something about it?
Yeah. So a little bit backing up, one thing that Reclaim Our Power has been working on over the past few months is establishing a cohort of organizations and groups who are ready to build these community resilience hubs. And so we've been really in this process of learning together through, you know, case studies, bringing hearing from folks who have built projects, mm-hmm. Not just in California, but in places like Puerto Rico, who have been building microgrids and building, you know, community ownership of clean energy resources. And so the one kind of, yeah, like most, I don't know, one project that I think is getting a lot of attention is... It's called RISE Commons. It's through the RISE Center in Richmond, which is basically a healing in community, healing hub and community center for youth. And they are expanding their building and really adding components or adding solar and storage in order to be able to serve as a community resilience hub, not just during outages, but really like as just a community center for folks to be able to access at all times. And one other component kind of a lot of these community resilience hubs, when we talk about you know, adding energy resources, is the fact that, you know, you're able to kind of provide some kind of economic benefits, either through reduced electricity bill usage, or basically selling power back to the grid, right? And with batteries, providing those extra capacity and all of that, and the different grid services, and that's a way to kind of like bring in money.
Okay. Listen, the last thing I wanted to raise was the argument that's been made that paying homeowners with solar rooftops for the electricity they put into the grid is actually subsidizing the well-off at the expense of the poor. I mean, could you explain the argument? And doesn't decentralization, won't that require a considerable amount of rooftop solar?
Yeah, so a lot of times the conversation around rooftop solar really centers homeowners, right? And when we think about kind of this current conversation that's been happening, it's about who has so far had access to putting solar on their roof. And it's people who own homes. It's affluent white folks on the whole. And so that is not something that is a solution for leading us to, you know, like complete transformation or, you know, climate justice, because it leaves so many folks out. And so really, without getting too much into the current debate, I think just expanding our understanding of like on-site solar, and the ways that that can benefit communities. So where we are able to, you know, make a financial case for putting money putting solar and storage on community centers, local businesses, you know, multifamily housing, having community solar in other ways. That, I think, really just shifting the conversation to not centering homeowners is really what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, yeah, that with that does include providing tariffs that will correct, I think, the inequities of that have been, you know, built into our current system that allows for decentralized power. So yes, decentralized power means power everywhere, not just on the rooftops of single family homes.
The decentralization argument, I think, relies heavily on the fact that our utility rates are about 2/3 transmission and distribution right now. They're really quite high, and of course that's money that PG&E is generating. And if you can generate locally, the presumption is that you don't have to pay the T&D rates. But of course that would bring another bankruptcy to PG&E. Do you have any sort of thoughts on that? And you also mentioned that you're finding out more about the difficulties or the obstacles that PG&E and the utilities are putting in front of microgrids. So this is a sort of a general question, you know, what does the future look like, or what should it look like?
Yeah. So you say that, you know, they're putting up a fight, not just in terms of microgrids, but really anything that's challenging their monopoly ownership of the current energy system. So you hear, you know, with you mentioned municipalization efforts earlier, where they're really, you know, refusing to even state a price for the city of San Francisco, for example, that wants to buy their wires. And so, you know, part of my work is definitely diving into the alternatives. And I think there isn't just one a one-size-fits-all solution, but there are a lot of models out there that we're learning from. And, you know, at a neighborhood level, that could look like cooperatively owned community solar and microgrids, municipal power agencies at the city level. And at the broader regional level, there are community choice aggregates who don't own the wires, but can, you know, provide generation. Mm-hmm. And rural electric cooperatives, of which there are a couple in California, who can own the wires. And one important thing to note is that, you know, all these options or these possibilities include both public and private ownerships. And so when we talk about cooperatives, for example, these are private entities that can be either for profit or not for profit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you talk about, you know, transmission and distribution as being the main way that, you know, the PG&E makes money. Again, the CPUC, so much of their, they have this current six-step accountability process that they've started. And really the goal of this process is pretty much to continue to let PG&E keep control of their system. But I will say that, you know, the final step of the success step process, which we are very actively pushing to get moved towards, is that PG&E's certificate for public necessity would be revoked. Mm-hmm. And what that basically means is that there would no longer be legally allowed to build transmission or generation infrastructure anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, and if it gets to that step, there's the process also allows for PG&E to be taken over by receiver. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of excitement, you know, around that bill, or around a bill that was created Golden State Energy last year, which was basically a very sparse bill that's basically a shell not-for-profit public benefit corporation that mm-hmm. could be triggered, but you know, there's no definition for what that could be yet.
Yeah.
And so that's really one thing we're in conversation to try to shape what that future could be. But it's a group process, you know, it's not, it's a collective effort envisioning and creating this future.
Well, Shana, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
Okay. If you'd like to learn more about Reclaim Our Power's Utility Justice Campaign, you can visit the website at reclaimourpowerca.org. And you can also find the Local Clean Energy Alliance at localcleanenergy.org/utilityjustice. So thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make KSQUID your community radio station. And that includes Emily Donham, who was engineer for this show. And so until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Break the power of banks and corporations, no borders, no nations, no coal power stations. We are unstoppable. Another world is possible. No more coal, no more oil. Keep your carbon in the soil.